Want to bring Fight the New Drug to your school, business, or community event? Lucky for you, we're pros when it comes to live presentations. We provide information and entertainment to inspire your audience to consider how pornography can impact themselves, their loved ones, and the world around them. We'll present the facts in an interactive, age-appropriate, and engaging way so your audience can walk away with more information on the harms of porn. To book a presentation, visit ftnd.org/live. That's ftnd.org/live.
My name is Garrett Johnson, and you're listening to Consider Before Consuming, a podcast by Fight the New Drug. And in case you're new here, Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. We want these conversations to be educational, uplifting, and hopeful. As we sit down with experts, influencers, activists, and people with personal accounts, we cover a wide variety of topics that may be triggering to some. You can refer to the episode notes for a specific trigger warning. Listener discretion is advised. Today's episode is a little bit different because it's about my own personal account. I sat down with Jasmine, Fight the New Drug's Director of Marketing and Partnerships, to discuss my journey with unwanted porn consumption. With that being said, let's jump into the conversation. We hope you enjoy this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Jazz, do you want to be the one to start this podcast off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I try it?
Yeah, do it.
Okay. What's up, people?
What's up, Jazz?
You're listening to Consider Before Consuming, a podcast by Fight the New Drug. And today we have a very special guest with us. We have Garrett Johnson, our podcast host and presenter, here to share his story and your personal experience with pornography. This episode we felt was kind of important. We wanted our audience to be able to get to know you and your experience, and so we wanted to give you your own episode so you can share your own personal story with our audience.
It's a pretty cool opportunity, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. And that's the goal, is to help change the conversation.
Absolutely. So if you guys haven't seen Garrett's story yet, pause this episode, go watch it. It's at ftnd.org/Garrett. And then you can just watch. It's like a, 3-4 minute video about your experience. It's one of the first true story videos that we have done at Fight the New Drug, one of the first ones that we shared. But you can see all about his story and how he went above and beyond to do crazy things to educate on the harmful effects of pornography.
And Jasmine, you had that short URL like on hand. It's ftnd.org/Garrett.
Garrett.
And I just want to recognize Jasmine is always, she's notorious for having those short URLs.
I know all of them. They're up here.
And the reason why is because you are our...
I'm the Director of Marketing and Partnerships here at Fight the New Drug. So we needed someone to interview you for your story, and so I jumped in to do that.
Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. Awesome. So let's get into your story. I'm going to try to be the best podcast host I can, but I've got some tough shoes to fill. But I just want to go ahead and get into your story. So hopefully you guys have paused this episode, went to go see his story. But let's just kind of start from the beginning of like when you were first exposed to pornography, what that was like, how old were you? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah. So I think if you saw the video, then that's like the short overview, like the 30,000 foot view of what my experience was. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to talk today because it is a little bit more in depth. But to answer your question about when was the first time I was exposed, in the video, you'll see that I say like around 9. Mm-hmm. And the video was made in like 2016. And since 2016, I've done a lot of healing, a lot of progression in my journey towards a healthier version of myself. And so during this process of digging, I've come to know that my first exposure was around the age of 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And so it was younger than I thought, but those memories, those were repressed for whatever reason.
Right.
Yeah, so first time exposure was around 5 or 6 years old, and it was in probably very common fashion, meaning that it was with my best friend at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were having a sleepover, and yeah, we were up late, and we saw some on TV. From that time forward, whenever I had an opportunity to consume pornography, I would do so.
Yeah.
But that required me to jump through some hoops, usually.
Right. Like, we always say that before you had to go out of your way to view pornography, now you have to go out of your way to avoid it. I pulled a couple stats for our episode, but I want to get this right, so I'm going to look at my notes. So according to a 2020 survey by the British Board of Film, of film classification, so the BBFC, the majority of kids were exposed to porn by the age of 13, but we know that from the survey, some kids were exposed as young as 7 years old. And we know from personal accounts like yours and stories that we get in from thousands of fighters that it could be even as young as like five or even younger than that, tragically. So, yeah, but I think I know what you're explaining. Like,
yeah.
You stay up late enough that the TV channel switches to adult content.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that at that age, when we first found it, and then going forward, mm-hmm. we intentionally jumped through hoops, just like you said, to stay up late.
Right.
To be able to consume it.
Right.
And yeah, today, kids, unfortunately, you know, they're having to jump through hoops to not see it.
Yeah. So when you saw it, was that like, did it shock you, or had you already been told about, like, pornography, adult content, explicit images from your family? Was that something your family talked about growing up?
So, like, growing up, when you say family, for me, my friends were my family, uh-huh. in a sense, because I was just really close to my friends. Mm-hmm. Also, I have a great family, like, blood family. Mm-hmm. So, the conversation with my family, with my parents, with my sibling, those conversations didn't happen around pornography. We didn't talk about whether it was healthy or unhealthy. And but the conversations around pornography did happen with my friends. Mm-hmm. And so the very first time exposure when I was 5 or 6, it was video. It was on TV. But then going forward, it was on magazine. Mm-hmm. And then in 6th grade, I was exposed to more of like a hardcore scene. And I remember feeling shocked. I remember feeling disgusted.
So you're kind of explaining, it sounds like, a little bit of an escalation there. So you're first exposed at like 5 or 6 years old. At what point did it like become kind of a compulsive behavior?
It's kind of a long time, because if you go to 6th grade and then going through junior high and high school, it was all normalized with my friends. And to the point that it became a compulsive behavior, we would have to fast forward to like 2007 is when I first got the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And so from 2007 to 2009, I was single and I was an adult, mm-hmm. and I had an iPhone in my pocket.
Yeah.
And so for me, I think my compulsive behavior began to develop around that time, from 2007 to around 2009, mm-hmm. is when it first started to develop into that.
Okay, I want to jump back a little bit, though, because you were talking about how it was kind of normalized when you were growing up in school, like even in elementary school. Again, I have another stat here. So according to a 2021 national representative survey of teens in the United States, 84.4% of 14 to 18-year-old males and 57% of 14 to 18-year-old females said they had viewed pornography. So, I mean, we hear this phrase all the time that, like, all men consume porn and those who say they don't are just lying. Did that ring a little bit true? Like, those stats and the national surveys show that, like, a high percentage of teen boys and girls are consuming porn, and for a majority of them, or not a majority, but 45% of them consume it to learn about sex. Is that kind of what your experience was like growing up with, like, your other classmates or your peers?
Yeah, I think that I can just speak to my personal account, and I definitely used pornography as a sex ed. My parents, they're great parents, but they didn't talk to me about sex. And so my education came through, a big portion of my education about sex came through pornography consumption. Mm-hmm. And that increased in junior high is when I started to watch more video versus just going to images in elementary. And so, yeah, it was an interesting way and an unhealthy way, in my opinion, to learn about sex, because it puts forth false expectations. And, you know, pornography is, I mean, there's a reason why they call them actors or performers.
Right.
Is because they are performing. And so it looks a lot different than what real sexual intimacy is.
Yeah. Especially when you consider how violent it is or how it lacks consent. And
yeah,
kids are using this to learn about sex and sexuality and intimacy. It can be very misleading.
Yeah. And I think this goes back to, like, that phrase that says that neurons that fire together wire together. Mm-hmm. Just like all those years of reinforcing this behavior, that when I was in the mood to consume pornography, pornography was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is something that I've had to unwire over the years, because sexual intimacy doesn't just require one person. Like, there's two people involved with, mm-hmm. in my case, with my spouse.
Right.
And so, once again, if you talk about reinforcing that behavior or that thought over years, I definitely had some unwiring to do, because mm-hmm. it almost, the wiring almost happens at a subconscious level, where you're not even aware
right.
that this is forming your view of sexuality.
Right. And you're probably watching it to, like, be better at sex or learn about intimacy. And do you feel like it helped you in that field of, like...
No. I think it actually created a lot of fear.
Yeah.
And stress and anxiety around that for me.
Sure.
So I would utilize it. I would engage in porn consumption. But I think subconsciously it was something that created fear in me because of the false expectations. Later, as I became sexually intimate with my spouse,
mm-hmm.
there was a little bit of fear there because of seeing so much pornography, but yet not engaging with real people.
Yeah.
Or a real person.
Yeah. Do you like, because looking back on your experience in high school, and you're saying, like, the status quo is, like, so that porn is, everyone watches it and it's healthy and everything like that. Like, do you wish you had known about Fight the New Drug back then, or had these kinds of resources to teach you about the negative effects of porn before it became kind of an issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at my personal account, once I had a counter voice
mm-hmm.
to the normalizing of pornography, and I heard the presentation by Fight the New Drug later in life, and we'll get into that,
mm-hmm.
That's when I felt the courage to finally take on this challenge and to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if I had heard this in junior high, I think that if either my caregivers or if there was a presentation at the junior high or high school mm-hmm. and it was given in a healthy way, I think that I would have really considered it. And I think that it would have changed the trajectory of my relationship with pornography. I think I would have considered before consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would have had healthier conversations. And now that's not to say that I would have never consumed pornography again.
Right.
But I think that I would have had healthier conversations with Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
And that we could have navigated that in a healthy way mm-hmm. instead of hiding it from her for several years.
Right.
So, yeah, to answer your question, I think that having a counter voice
mm-hmm.
as a youth would have definitely helped me.
Yeah. Helped you, like, consider how pornography can be harmful in these ways. And
yeah, because I was just consuming pornography in an impulsive way at that time.
Right.
There was no forethought of possible consequences in the future. It was just right then and there. And I think that having that information would have helped me.
Yeah. In what ways did you experience then that pornography negatively affected you?
Once I get porn in my pocket around the age of 21.
Mm-hmm.
So from 21 until about 24 is I have even more reinforcement.
Mm-hmm. Because that's kind of when the smartphone came out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was single and I was, like I said, I was an adult. So I had more stressors and more, you know, things to deal with in life. And so I would turn to pornography if I had, like, anxiety or stress, or if I felt lonely, or if I wanted to engage in some escapism,
mm-hmm.
all of these reasons, I would turn to pornography, especially during that period of time from 2007 to 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Ariel in 2009. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that once I get married, I won't consume pornography anymore. Mm-hmm. I had that standard for myself.
Like you almost wouldn't need it anymore.
Yeah. It's challenging for me to admit that perspective because it kind of goes back to objectification. And when I say that, like, I'm not going to consume pornography because I'm going to have a significant other, it's almost like I'm going to go from using pornography to using my significant other, right? And I don't really like that. So I'm kind of like, I just don't like that perspective. It's it's challenging for me to admit that. But that's really what it was, I think. And so getting into our relationship, my relationship with Ariel, I was dating a lot, but once I met Ariel, it was a little bit different. And I was like, man, I love this girl. I remember, you know, getting to know her and but not wanting her to find out about my porn consumption.
Right.
And so as we dated and as we got engaged and as we got married, we had no conversations about porn consumption.
Right.
And so I think that answering the question of how it affected me, it's like this, my sexuality was built on pornography.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of ways that it negatively affected me. And I think one of the main ones is that it encouraged me. I made the decision ultimately, so I'm not pushing all the blame to pornography, but it encouraged me to introduce deceit into our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because soon after we got married, I turned back to pornography. You know, it wasn't that easy to just say, once I'm married, I'm not going to consume porn anymore.
Yeah. Well, I just want to validate that because I feel like a lot of people's experiences, like they consume porn before they get into a relationship. And then I think it's easy to just assume that having a sexual partner now, you just assume that you're not going to need the porn anymore because now you have someone to be intimate with. But more often than not, that's not really the case.
Yeah. And so my porn consumption didn't have anything to do with Ariel.
No, yeah.
I think that there was things that happened in our relationship that triggered me where I would turn back to it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, my habit and my challenge with pornography was developed way before meeting her.
Yeah, has nothing to do with her or her worth or value. Or,
right.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to note because if we have listeners or individuals who have experienced the harmful effects of pornography where they're on the other side, they're the ones who are receiving this and experiencing some betrayal trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not a reflection of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what else or how else did it affect me negatively? It introduced things like I said, impulsivity, which led to compulsivity, which led to arrogance, resentments, entitlement, shame, excessive preoccupation in my mind with pornography.
What do you mean by that? Excessive preoccupation?
So, like, if you look at the Mayo Clinic and you say define what is compulsive sexual behavior, one of the things that they talk about in that definition is excessive preoccupation. And so this is how my day would go, my typical day in the life of someone who has experienced a compulsive sexual behavior. And what would happen is around 11 or so, 11 a.m. in the morning, I would start to think, okay, you know, I'm going to consume porn tonight. And then I would consume porn. And then after consuming porn, I would say, never again. Like, I'm just sick of it. I don't like this feeling. It left me more lonely.
Mm-hmm.
It left me, you know, it increased my loneliness. It increased my isolation. It increased the deceit. And so I would say, no, I don't want this. And I'd be like, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to turn to pornography. I'm not going to consume pornography again. And then at 11 a.m. the next day, I was like, maybe just one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go through periods of time where I would give up hope of dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be like, this is just who I am.
Just like accept the fact that you struggle with this.
Yeah. And so that was the hopeless side of like, dang, like I just don't know if I'm ever going to be able to overcome
mm-hmm.
this compulsive behavior. And then I would just be like, I just got to accept it.
Yeah. How many times do you think you like tried to stop, like, and went through the whole, like, never again, and then it happened, like?
From 2000, I think when I first started wanting to stop was around 2008,
okay.
2009. And then when I got married, that's really when it started to be like, here, you need to stop consuming this. Mm-hmm. It's a wedge between your relationship. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think about the quote by the Gottmans.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to state that quote because I think it's really powerful. It says that we are led to unconditionally conclude that for many reasons, pornography poses a serious threat to couple intimacy and relationship harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I hear that quote, that it poses a serious threat to couple intimacy and relationship harmony,
mm-hmm.
and then I go to 2010 when I got married and I was like, I need to stop this because I could feel that that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
It was creating a wedge between us.
Mm-hmm.
And as I tried to stop, answering your question, like, how many times did I try to stop?
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't have an answer. It was just a lot of times.
Right.
And there was, like I said, there was times of, like, hopelessness. Of, like, okay, I just got to accept that this is me.
Right. And I only ask because I feel like a lot of our listeners who are currently struggling and maybe are in that place of feeling hopeless and they've stopped and started and stopped and started so many times, maybe hearing your story is like really inspiring, but also just acknowledging that like it took a lot for you to get to this point.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think about that quote, the brain, the neurons that fire together, wire together, it's like that wiring process
mm-hmm.
takes time Absolutely. To develop. And it takes a lot of time to unwire it as well. I think you're right as well. Like sometimes I had this all or nothing mentality where it was like, if I consumed porn, like might as well consume it tonight again kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the healthiest approach to have that all or nothing mentality right. because sometimes there is a gradual mm-hmm. change that has to occur. It's not an overnight
right.
type of situation.
Yeah. And I think that all or nothing mentality can apply to so many things. Like I skipped the gym today, might as well like go get a pizza. Right. Like,
totally.
Like things I could relate to. Totally. Right. But,
and I don't think that we're condoning like a little bit of pornography consumption.
Right. But just having a little bit of compassion for yourself and acknowledging that like it took a long time to get to the point where you're struggling with pornography and it might take a while for you to unwire that process.
Yeah. Totally. And I think that I was definitely in that, like people say, like the shame cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think that's what you're referring to.
Right.
If someone turns to pornography and then they're like, well, this makes me a bad person because I don't even have self-control over this. Like, right. how do I, that's a thought that I had often was like, how do I lack the self-control to not consume mm-hmm. this?
And then shame is like, I am a bad person. And then you're thinking that like, because you don't have the control to do that, like there must be something wrong with you. Like,
yeah.
So I want to go back to something you said, because you mentioned that you and Ariel, your lovely wife, had never talked about pornography, even in the beginning of your relationship. So can we speak a little bit to that and why maybe it could have been better had you discussed it earlier on in the relationship?
Yeah, I think that it would have been better because I could have been genuine.
Mm-hmm.
It would have given her the opportunity to accept me for me
mm-hmm.
at that time. And then also, I think that part of the problem with compulsive behaviors is that usually they grow in secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
There's that tendency of secrecy.
Right.
So I think that being open about it could have really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it could have eliminated my shame.
Yeah.
And I think what it really comes down to is that I could have finally accepted myself for myself. Because if I'm hiding this thing, I'm not only not allowing her to accept me because I'm lacking the openness,
mm-hmm.
but I'm also not allowing myself. I'm not accepting myself because I'm trying to hide this thing. And so I think having that conversation beforehand and during our relationship ongoing could have been very helpful and very healthy. Because she didn't know about my porn consumption, And we went through about 5.5 years of marriage without her knowing that I was consuming porn. And I'm like, I'm not proud to say that.
Right.
And I do want to, like, going back to your quote or your explanation, you mentioned that sometimes people will say that all guys watch porn. And I don't want to create fear in listeners who, you know, aren't having conversations, whether it's with their kids or with their significant other. They're not having conversations. And so maybe the fact that I went through 5 years of marriage without my spouse knowing, maybe it creates some fear in them, like, oh, my spouse, because we're not having conversations, it's like guaranteed that my spouse is consuming porn.
Right.
And I just want to acknowledge that that's not always the case.
No. Yeah.
Just not all guys watch porn. Not all girls watch porn. And so the conversation, like, the healthiest way to find out is to talk about it in a healthy way and find out.
Absolutely. And to have an ongoing conversation, because one day you can be talking with your kids or your spouse and ask them if they watch pornography or have been exposed to pornography and what their relationship with pornography is like, if they have one. And but even if they're not watching pornography today, you know, years down the road, things could change. Like, it's so prevalent right now that chances are they could have been exposed or they could have developed a habit by then. So that's why it's so important to have an ongoing, healthy conversation about the issue of pornography.
Yeah. And it's nice today, like, comparing where Ariel and I are at today to where we were 5 or 6 years ago, is today Ariel can check my phone whenever she wants. And I leave my phone and, you know, it's, there isn't the secrecy.
Right. That's like a boundary that you guys have already established. Like, we're not saying go check your spouse's phone without them knowing, but, like, that's something that you guys have
exactly. Yeah, that's a good clarification.
Yeah.
Good clarification. Yeah. So even today, it kind of made me happy, actually. Today I woke up and I, like, couldn't find my phone. And it made me happy because 6 years ago, I always knew where my phone was.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And I'm not saying that people who, someone, just because they know where their phone's at, they have a challenge with pornography. I'm not trying to say that. But in my case, I always knew where my phone was. And so to wake up today and, like, not know where it was and have to search for it, I'm like, yes.
Like, it's like
what
a little,
good feeling.
Yeah, a little bit of a sign of, like, how well you're doing.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was kind of a cool little thing.
That's great.
And then going back to, like, the conversation and having a conversation, if we would have had a conversation about it, I think that it would have helped our sex life, like our sexual, our level of sexual intimacy as a couple.
Yeah.
Because I was engaging in deceit and consuming porn without Ariel knowing, there was problems there that occurred because of that. Where if we had that open dialogue, it would have been different. And let me give you an example. So pornography was always there. Whenever I wanted to turn to pornography, it was there and ready.
Right.
And one of the problems as you go into a committed relationship is that, again, like I mentioned, it takes, it's two people.
Right.
It takes another person to engage. And if Ariel's libido was at a different level that day than mine was, I had this false expectation because this thought had been reinforced that when I was in, when I wanted to consume pornography, pornography was there.
Yeah.
There was no other libido.
Right.
Right? And so sometimes what would happen in our relationship is that if I wanted to engage in that way and her libido was at a different stage that day, then I would turn to pornography. And what would happen is that that created resentments in me toward Ariel.
Right.
And it also created a level of arrogance, like that I kind of thought that my thoughts, feelings, and emotions and desires were more important than Ariel's. And it kind of goes back to the objectification part, that you stop seeing a person as a person with thoughts, feelings, and emotions, the communication drops, and then the arrogance increases. So when I say that it increased, like, resentments and arrogance, that's a small example.
Yeah.
As to how that occurred in my personal account.
Yeah. Well, and I love how you're talking about, like, communication also and how pornography and, like, instilled some deceit there. Because just being communicative in general can just increase intimacy, but also like communicating about sex and sexuality with your partner is like extremely important. And we always say that like you shouldn't take sex tips from an industry that profits off of fake orgasms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just like learning sex from pornography instead of with your partner, who's a unique person that, you know, has different like desires or a different libido or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's been nice to introduce that healthy discussion into our relationship.
Absolutely.
And we're kind of benefiting from that now.
Mm-hmm.
But for 6 years, about five and a half, right. 6 years of marriage, we didn't have that.
Yeah. So can we talk about like what, I mean, I know, but our listeners might not. What got you to open up to Ariel about your struggle with pornography?
I think for the first 20 something years, it seemed like my porn consumption was consequence free.
Mm.
And then when I met Ariel and going in to the relationship, I started thinking, okay, maybe I do want to stop this. There are negative effects.
Mm-hmm.
But I still didn't have that counter voice. And I happened to see a presentation by Fight the New Drug. And before going to this presentation, I did not know who Fight the New Drug was.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I didn't have a counter voice to the voices saying that this is normal.
Right.
Porn is normal. And so I heard the presentation by Fight the New Drug, not the entire presentation. I came in when it was already started.
Was it just like at a school or?
Yeah, my wife is a coach at the high at a high school here locally.
Mm-hmm.
And Fight the New Drug was doing a community event. And so we were sharing a car at the time. And so I went to go pick up Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 2015.
Okay.
I went to go pick up Ariel from the high school and I went in to wait for her. I saw that Fight the New Drug was there, and so I sat down and watched their presentation.
I'll just kill some time and sit down and watch whatever this presentation is. Yeah. Turns out it's about the harms of porn.
Yeah, it was like 7 o'clock on a Thursday, you know? So I'm like, all right, I'll just sit here for a second. And it was really cathartic to see the science and mm-hmm. to hear some of the personal accounts and see some of the facts
mm-hmm.
because it was validating my experience.
Yeah, what you're actually living and experiencing.
Yeah, because and up until that moment with the presentation, I was internally like trying to decide if what I was feeling was a justified belief
mm-hmm.
or if it was just my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, was I really experiencing some type of compulsive behavior? Or was it just my, was I perceiving it that way?
Mm-hmm.
And so as I heard the science and facts and personal accounts that Fight the New Drug was presenting, it started to make me believe that what I was experiencing was a justified belief. Like it was, my belief was justified in the sense mm-hmm. that I was experiencing a compulsive behavior.
Like here's all the science and research validating everything that you're experiencing.
Yep. And that was the first counter voice really that I heard. And because it was delivered in a healthy way,
mm-hmm.
it actually eliminated my shame.
That's awesome.
Not, I don't think completely,
right.
but it started to reduce it.
Yeah, like it's not me that's a bad person.
Yeah.
It's this behavior that is unhealthy.
Yeah. And I guess the education, another way to say that is that the education like helped me have empathy for myself a little bit.
Yeah.
And to accept what it was.
I love that.
And so Ariel finishes her practice and she comes and she sits down with me and she watches some of the presentation with me. And we ended up leaving a little bit early before the presentation ended.
Mm-hmm.
But I left with a desire to tell Ariel the truth. And up until that point, I hadn't accepted the potential consequences. Like, I was scared to mm-hmm. tell the truth. Because I loved our relationship. And so that fear of the potential consequences
mm-hmm.
silenced me. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I can't tell Ariel. Because then it comes to the point where she's going to have her opinion.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure you're also a little afraid of, like, is she going to want to leave me? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or work through this with me? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
And is it going to change her perspective of me?
Yeah.
So anyway, leaving that presentation was the first time that I was like, okay, I need to accept these potential consequences and just tell the truth. And A few weeks later, I finally got the courage to tell the truth. And it wasn't in the best way because, again, I had very little resources mm-hmm. telling me how to navigate this situation.
Right. Looking back and now knowing what you know, you probably realize yeah. there's maybe a better way to say it.
Exactly. Because we were laying down in bed mm-hmm. and it was dark, like the lights were off, we were getting ready for bed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I need to tell you something. But then I lost courage for a second. Mm. For a couple minutes, and okay. I'm just sitting there in silence in the dark, you know. So if you can imagine, I made it more challenging for her and for myself.
Yeah, she was probably a little panicked exactly. just hearing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd be a little panicked, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. And so if you can learn one thing from our experience, that would be to go to ftnd.org/blueprint.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's a good plug for our interactive conversation guide. So it's a website we created that you can go there, select who you want to talk to specifically. It can be a spouse, a child, a friend, or a stranger about pornography, and then you select what specifically you want to talk about. If you're struggling, if they're struggling, or just having a general conversation, and then we give you some helpful tips to help navigate you through this discussion, because it in your experience and in a lot of people's experience, it's not always an easy conversation to have, and it's a very
I don't know if it ever is.
Yeah, I mean, even working here and talking to people about what we do for a living, like, it's not an easy conversation to yeah. have with people. It's very intimate, it's so taboo, and can be kind of tricky to navigate. So if you're wanting to have a healthy conversation about pornography, we encourage you to go to ftnd.org/blueprint to access that conversation guide.
Yeah. And I don't just plug that URL to plug it.
Right.
That's not in the script or something. I just genuinely would have benefited from that. Yeah, so I didn't have the resources, but I did have 3 weeks behind me with no porn consumption. And so I was like, this is the
That's
time
phenomenal.
To finally
yeah.
tell the truth.
Yeah.
And even back then, so this is back in 2015, and our family has a phrase that we kind of live by.
Yeah.
And I have it inked like as a permanent reminder, and the phrase is that moments of bliss are not free.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love that.
I remember even thinking then, like, finally I accepted the potential consequences. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, moments of bliss are not free. Like, if I want to experience increased happiness, like another level, a higher level of happiness or a higher level of intimacy with Ariel,
mm-hmm.
If I want to experience genuineness and acceptance and empathy, a higher level of love, if mm-hmm. I want to experience those things, then I have to pay the price. Like, I have mm-hmm. to pay the price. And the price was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured, like, I can either pay the price now and tell the truth, or if I wait and keep that deceit alive,
mm-hmm.
eventually I'm going to have to pay the price.
Right.
It's either now or later. And so I told her, and I don't want to, like, skip over or, like, breeze past this experience because it's a very serious thing,
mm-hmm.
and it can be very traumatizing for both parties, for the person that's disclosing and the person that's receiving this information.
Mm-hmm.
When I told her, you know, it was challenging, it was heartbreaking, and it wasn't. That was just the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was just the very first, one of the very first steps for me. It was education was the very first step,
mm-hmm.
and then telling the truth was next.
Yeah,
and you know, I had this reinforced behavior for years and years, that if I had a problem, if I was experiencing stress or loneliness or anxiety, to turn to pornography and ignore that
mm-hmm.
problem.
Right.
And oftentimes it would amplify that problem.
Yeah.
And because I wasn't taking on that challenge or facing that challenge or that feeling or that emotion.
Or just dealing with whatever the underlying issue actually was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so it just amplified. For a moment, it caused a hiccup in our relationship. Like, our relationship, it became more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
For a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Right. You mentioned that the first step for you was like educating yourself on the harmful effects of pornography and then disclosing that to Ariel. At one point, if you guys haven't seen Garrett's video, again, go watch it, fdnd.org/Garrett. But at what point did you decide, hey, I want to run 30 marathons in 30 days in handcuffs to raise awareness on the harms of pornography? Like, how'd you get to that point?
Because that's there to there.
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of fighters like worldwide who like to educate on this issue, but you chose a really unique way to educate on this issue. So, I mean, what gave you that idea and why to that scale did you want to educate people about the harms of porn?
So I had several months with no porn consumption, and a lot of that was just because of the education and telling the truth. Like, those two things alone were very freeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that since seeing the presentation, I didn't consume pornography ever again after that,
because mm-hmm.
that's not the case. I did, and then I would remember, oh, actually, I don't want this in my life,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd move forward.
Right.
But those two things were really crucial and helped me tremendously. And so after stringing together several months without any pornography consumption and starting to see improvements in our relationship, I was like, man, I want other people to be able to experience this as well.
Right.
Because based off the trends that I was seeing, or even in my personal account and knowing other people in my life within my inner circles, I wondered if unwanted porn consumption was more common than mm-hmm. I thought. And I just thought of other people out there who were feeling how I felt and not knowing about the harmful effects or not being able to consider before consuming. And so I was talking to Ariel about how I could build awareness, and I was working in the fitness industry at the time.
Hmm.
And I have a history of like doing some endurance events.
Yeah.
And so I took that talent of like finishing endurance events, and I'm like, can I incorporate this somehow to build awareness for Fight the New Drug? And at the time it was all about Fight the New Drug for me, because that's where I got the information.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to acknowledge also that there were a lot of other organizations and other people
mm-hmm.
fighting the harmful effects of pornography or educating on the harmful effects of pornography
mm-hmm.
At the time. But for me, it was just Fight the New Drug.
Right.
I was about to turn 30 years old. I was 29. And in January of 2016, I presented this idea to Ariel to do 30 marathons in 30 days wearing handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I presented the idea, we were talking through like the logistics of it, and we decided that I could do it, but if I did, I would probably have to quit my job. And so I quit my job and I did 30 and 30 in handcuffs. The reason why I chose to run 30 marathons in handcuffs was to show like the definition of compulsivity
mm-hmm.
is that you're desire to not consume or engage in that behavior
mm-hmm.
is overridden by the compulsive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ran 30 marathons in 30 days. And technically, I ran like 25 marathons because I had what's called Substitute Saturday.
Right.
And during these marathons, my goal was to build awareness for Fight the New Drug.
Uh-huh.
I did not want to talk about my personal account. My goal in these 30 marathons was to simply like build awareness for Fight the New Drug.
Mm-hmm.
And so through marathon 26, I hadn't talked about my personal account. And Ariel, like after I would come home from this marathon mm-hmm. and we were talking, she's like, well, if like your goal is to change the conversation and you're wanting to eliminate shame and like make it easier to talk about, then maybe you should talk about your personal account as well. And so at Marathon 26 is kind of when I talked about my personal account.
Wow.
And during these marathons, it was kind of cool because at the same time as I was performing these marathons, Terry Crews came out on Facebook or on YouTube and mm-hmm. talked about his challenge with pornography.
Yeah, his Dirty Little Secret video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People messaged me and they're like, did you hear that Terry Crews is talking about this as well? And I was like, wow, that's cool. The timing was really cool because it was in the exact moment that I was running these marathons. And so we reached out to Terry Crews and we were like, can you participate in one of our substitute Saturdays mm-hmm. where people could run for me to help build more awareness. Him and his boy went out and ran, and they posted on social media about yeah. Substitute Saturday. So that was really cool.
It's awesome.
And again, it helped build awareness, yeah. and that was the goal.
Yeah. And since then, you've interviewed Terry Crews on this podcast. Yeah. So if you haven't listened to it already, go and listen to it. We have a video of it too, so you can go and watch that interview with Terry Crews talking about yeah. pornography.
Yeah, Terry Crews is, I look up Terry Crews, and so it was cool to have his support mm-hmm. in that way at that time.
What was like the general reaction you got from people when, I mean, like your friends and family, like you're running 30 marathons, 30 days, and, you know, like you said in the beginning of it, it wasn't even because like you had struggled with porn, you just wanted to raise awareness for Fight the New Drug. And
yeah, I think that my parents and Ariel's parents and our friends, I think there was, you know, some healthy skepticism.
Yeah.
Of like, what are they doing? Why?
Garrett's quitting his job?
Yeah, like, it just doesn't, it's not very common.
Yeah.
And so we embraced that. I guess we embraced that uncertainty. We weren't exactly sure what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to build awareness. I felt like pornography consumption, like I said, problematic porn consumption was more common than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like if I had this information before, it would have saved me years of dealing with this alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because once I had that cathartic experience, it really helped me. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to provide that for someone else, you know? Right.
Well, and that's like what we here at Fight the New Drug are all about. Like, we're not here to ban pornography or to like restrict adults' rights to view legal forms of pornography. Like, we're just here to educate so people know, because it's so the mainstream narrative is that porn is normal and porn's okay and porn is healthy and everyone watches it and it's okay. But we're just here to shine a light on the fact that, like, actually decades of research shows that there are harmful effects of pornography.
Yeah.
So we're just here to educate so people can make a decision. That's all you were wanting to do with raising awareness.
Right. And that's why I hitched my wagon to Fight the New Drug, in a sense, because of the fact that the mission statement was just to educate
mm-hmm.
so that people can make an educated decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I finished the 30 marathons, or I guess one thing that's kind of interesting to look at with the handcuffs is that as I ran, if you can imagine me running, like mm-hmm. my arms are in this almost like running position.
Right.
And even though it was really restrictive, it wasn't that challenging to run with handcuffs on because your hands are like bent.
Right.
Your arms are bent in this position anyway. So I think that a little bit of symbolism there is like you never know who's having a challenge with pornography. It doesn't matter what the gender is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what their political persuasion is or their mm-hmm. religion is or isn't.
Or their age, yeah.
Or their age, you know. Because a lot of people didn't see my handcuffs. That was the symbolism.
Yeah.
Is that I ran and people didn't really ask, like, why are you running with handcuffs?
Or even because realized you were running with handcuffs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why, again, going back to why is it important to have conversations, like, I think those healthy conversations would have helped mm-hmm. me.
Even if you didn't disclose it when someone asked you the first time or the second time, like, just knowing that someone's interested or that they're there to have a conversation with when you're ready to disclose that is, I think, important.
Yeah. And then moving on from the 30 marathons, once I finished the 30 marathons, I wanted to build awareness a little bit more. And going back to like my, I guess a little bit of history might help on like how I got into endurance events or like endurance events that I've done.
Yeah.
Because I have that little bit of like this, I think they're fun.
Yeah, and you're one of those crazy people who think
Yeah, I guess so. And so I have run like 100 miles straight in an event called the Wasatch 100.
Wow.
And then I've also done like a full Ironman. And then I've ridden my bike from Vancouver, Canada to the bottom of Washington on like a self-supported tour.
Oh.
And I've done a marathon anyway. So I've done these things. And so I knew that I was decent at endurance events.
Uh-huh.
And so I did the 30 marathons in 30 days. And then when I was done with that, I looked at my bucket list item because I'm like, I want to still build awareness. I already quit my job.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I can do one more project before, you know, getting back to having a job.
Right.
The normal life. And so I was looking at a bucket list that I wrote in high school. And one of the items on my bucket list was to ride my bike across the United States. And I didn't know if I would ever do it. One of my friends and I joked about doing it for like our senior trip and going coast to coast on a bike. But that never happened. And I honestly didn't know if it would ever happen because it was just such a big undertaking.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, like, what if I did something and incorporated a bike ride across the United States? And so I went to Ariel and presented this idea to her. And her first response was that you have to do it. And then her one of the first things that she said after that was that you can't quit. Like, if you decide to go out there to Virginia with your bike by yourself to venture across the United States, you cannot come home early. And
man, she's cool.
Yeah, she is. I appreciate that. Honestly, because it was a standard. I would have given up, I bet, if she hadn't set that standard.
Yeah.
Because it was really challenging. I went out to Virginia, and I was getting ready to do this project by myself. And I remember riding, and, you know, those first several days, I'm riding. I've never done this. I didn't prepare for this in, like, the most ideal way. I had never ridden my bike but with chains.
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge, you didn't just ride your bike across the United States. You were dragging chains behind you.
Yeah, exactly. So I had never done that before. I had never ridden a bike with chains dragging behind me until day one.
And neither have I, believe it or not. Yeah, exactly. I have not done that.
It's not a common thing, and I was one of those people who had never done it. And so on day one, I start riding with these chains, and I'm like, man, this is going to be more challenging than I thought. And the chains represented, like, the heaviness of the harmful effects of pornography. And I kind of wanted it to resemble, like, whether you're experiencing, like, the betrayal trauma side or whether you're experiencing, like, the person with the problematic porn consumption. Both sides, you know, it's very challenging. And so I start this ride with chains dragging, and I start realizing, man, this is going to be more challenging than I thought. And
you can't go home.
I cannot.
Ariel won't let you.
Exactly. And at first, I was like, I want to have all these conversations with all these people. And then it got to the point where I just want to put my head down. Like, I just need to grind
No one talked to me. I need to get home.
Yeah. So I decided to just go. And I started realizing that the carabiners that attached the chains to my bike started to wear away. And I got real happy, you know, because I was like, okay, I wasn't planning on this. I was planning on pulling the chains all the way across the United States. But at day 21, all the chains had fallen away. So I was riding through the Appalachian Mountains, through Virginia and Kentucky, just hill after hill after hill. And finally, day 21, the chains fell off. And there was great analogy there because I was experiencing the unwiring process of my chains, you know? And it was cool to feel that, have that physical representation.
Yeah. That symbolism.
Yeah. Because I was by myself. And I think that when it came down to it, like, this is my challenge. And I kind of brought Ariel into the challenge because we got married, and so that it becomes her challenge as well.
Right.
But I really had to deal with this thing on my own, in a sense. Like, it was mine.
Right.
My challenge. There were my chains behind my bike. And
that you have to drag through. And,
And so finally they fell off. And it was a great feeling because I was able to go a lot faster and get to the end quicker.
Right.
And I had a lot of cool experiences because we didn't have a ton of funds. Like, we didn't have this excess amount of savings where I was, like, staying in hotels. So I was camping. Like, I slept in a bivy. So I slept all over the place. Like, I slept on the front lawn at a post office. I slept on I met people at a restaurant, and then I slept on their trampoline.
Oh. Like,
and someone in Missouri let me stay in their villa.
Wow.
Anyway, some really cool experiences, but some also very challenging ones. Like, I remember one time in Virginia, I was super down. Like, it had been a long day, you know, I'm exhausted, and I get to this point where I don't have anywhere to stay, And it's not in like a gray area to stay, mm-hmm. meaning like it was just really like a forest.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like house every like 4 miles, you mm-hmm. know. And I pull up to this house and they have their garage open. I can see their garage offset off the street like mm-hmm. a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ride up there close to the house. They're like, who is this creep, you know? And then I'm like, can I stay in your garage? This is what I'm doing. And anyway, so we actually ended up playing, like, they invited me over for family night.
Oh.
Like, they were playing games and stuff. And I slept in their garage.
What a trusting family. Because I know you're a great guy, but that would maybe weird me out a little.
Oh, yeah. It was weird for sure. And I felt awkward asking.
Yeah.
But I was like, I just need somewhere to stay. And they checked my Facebook or my Instagram, you know, and they were like, okay, he at least has some, like, friends.
Yeah.
Like, could be a normal person. But, yeah, so it was an interesting experience. I got to meet a lot of people, and the goal was to build awareness.
Yeah, I'm sure that sparked a lot of conversations about why you were doing what you were doing.
Yeah. One of the funniest conversations that happened was, because I was dragging chains, there was one time where a car flips around and they came up to me and they were like pointing to my chains and they're like, hey, like something's dragging behind your bike. And it was obviously intentional. And so we had some good conversations that way.
Yeah.
And when I finished in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
56 days later, and Ariel met me there and we rode the last mile together.
It's awesome.
Like I actually gave her like, what's the word, like a pump, mm-hmm. like on the bike.
Yeah.
Like she was sitting on the back uh-huh. on the seat and I'm like cranking away.
Wait, here. You rode on the same bike for the mm-hmm. last mile?
Yeah.
Was it one of those tandem bikes?
No,
oh just my
gosh. The bike that I used all the way across.
Wow.
And so we finished the last little bit together.
That's awesome.
And so that was a cool experience.
That's really cool.
And then the goal of doing these projects was not only to build awareness in the moment,
mm-hmm.
but also to do some type of video. And so Fight the New Drug actually reached out soon mm-hmm. after the project. And they're like, we want to do a little video on your experience.
Mm-hmm.
So they created a video. And they started using that video in their presentations. Mm-hmm. And I was stoked about that because, yeah. again, that was the whole purpose.
To give other people your story and,
that yeah. cathartic experience, mm-hmm. exactly. So they created this video, they start using it in their presentations, and then they're like, do you want to present your own video? And
like be a presenter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I say present my own video, what I mean is, yeah, exactly, be a presenter, talk about how it affects the brain, the heart, and the world,
mm-hmm.
and then included in that presentation is the short video mm-hmm. on my experience.
How like full circle this, because this all started because you saw a presentation, yeah, exactly. and now they're asking you to be a presenter
yeah.
and be that for somebody else.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I got jobs that allowed flexibility
mm-hmm.
when I got back from the ride across the United States. And because they had offered that opportunity to present, I wanted to get jobs that allowed me to be flexible enough to leave whenever mm-hmm. I was asked to go present.
Mm-hmm.
My goal was to never deny a presentation opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is because I was just like, there's a kid out there mm-hmm. who I want to give that person an opportunity to consider before consuming. And so mm-hmm. anyway, fast forward to today, and it's been pretty cool because I've presented to nearly 200 audiences
yeah.
in over 20 states and 3 countries. And
wow.
I never expected that. Like I said, the first 26 marathons,
uh-huh.
I didn't even want to share my personal account.
Right.
You know? And because of the series of events, I ended up sharing yeah. it. And today it's something that, you know, I talk yeah. about for a job.
How has sharing your story on such like a grand scale helped you in your recovery?
I think I never participated in the 12-step program.
Uh-huh.
But I do know that the 12th step is to help someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did the 30 and 30 in handcuffs or coast to coast in chains, that was part of my 12th step, mm-hmm. was helping someone else. I thought that I would go back to work, you know, to have a normal job
mm-hmm.
and just continue on with my life. And so it's kind of been a weird series of events to now share my experience on a bigger platform.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I'm just grateful for an organization like Fight the New Drug.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I wouldn't have had this opportunity to learn this information, and I also wouldn't have this opportunity to help other people
mm-hmm.
receive this information if it wasn't for all of the people invited mm-hmm. or all of the people involved with yeah. Fight the New Drug. But it's kind of intimidating to share your story.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's gratitude there.
Mm-hmm.
I also think there's like humility of like, man, this is kind of challenging. It humbles you a little bit when you have to share something. So you have to be vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Well,
I just wanted to say that the gratitude and appreciation absolutely goes the same way, because I think in the beginning, your willingness to speak up about this and then make a video and like ride your bike across the United States and like start presenting your story. And now as the podcast host, like your story is really inspirational. And just the fact that you're so willing to share it to help educate other people and help inspire other people who are probably struggling, like is yeah. phenomenal. So
yeah,
we appreciate you.
Well, thanks. I think it's important to note that if you think about like Alcoholics Anonymous,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason why they call it Alcoholics Anonymous and not like Alcoholics Identified, because there's like benefits to anonymity.
Uh-huh.
And so coming out publicly with this experience like this, they sometimes people say like, don't share the things like this on a public platform.
Mm.
Because there are, like, some challenging things about it.
Right. We're not saying everyone has to recover exactly. from porn. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was my point in doing mm-hmm. in saying that, is that it's important to increase your self-awareness and decide how you want to or who you want to trust
mm-hmm.
with this experience.
Yeah. You don't have to disclose it to everyone.
No.
So at what point, then, did Fight the New Drug come to you with the idea to start a podcast?
It was a couple years ago, and I think that they were looking for a new medium.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, we've wanted to start a podcast for a long time, but it just hasn't been right, whether it was timing or resources or all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And they reached out to me, and they said, we have an opportunity to start a podcast. Would you want to be involved in that process?
Mm-hmm. Asking if you'd want to be the host, like, was yeah. that known off the bat?
Yep, they did. They did say that, ask that off the bat.
Wow.
You know, I feel fortunate for the opportunity to help Fight the New Drug in this way. And it's been a cool experience. It's been a couple years now since we've yeah. started the podcast.
I think it's been about 2 years now.
Yeah.
Since we
lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, since we launched, not lost. But since we launched our first episode. So yeah, it's been 2 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you go look at the podcast and all the episodes that we have, we've had just such a wide variety of people
mm-hmm.
that have come and shared their expertise or their experiences.
Yeah.
And it's been really humbling to like have all these people that say, "Yeah, I want to help out in this
mm-hmm.
way. I want to help change the conversation."
Absolutely.
And I'm a person who I love hearing about people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things I love about the podcast, is I just love hearing about people's experiences. And it's been really a cool thing.
That's awesome. Well, Garrett, I want to just leave with one more question for you. We've talked about, you know, your struggle with pornography and the negative effects that you've experienced and, you know, what you did to try to raise awareness and be that voice for someone else. So what would you say to the listener or whoever is watching this who's currently struggling with pornography? What advice would you give to that person who's maybe in that place that you were before you found Fight the New Drug? They're feeling a little bit helpless and a lot of shame and just aren't really sure if there's a way through this.
I think that you can take away from my personal account a couple things that are key, and it's that the education side,
mm-hmm.
continue to get educated, to have healthy conversations, and then that second step of engaging in openness and self-disclosure
mm-hmm.
and doing that with a trusted someone
mm-hmm.
whether that's a friend or a family member or a significant other. And that honesty will allow you to finally accept you for you,
mm-hmm.
right? I talked about how because I was hiding it, I wasn't accepting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't allowing other people to accept me. And so I think those first two steps, education and then telling the truth, even if it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage you to do that. And it comes back to like being proactive instead of reactive. There's a lot to say. There's a lot to be said for someone who takes that proactive approach
mm-hmm.
rather than like getting caught
mm-hmm.
or getting in a position where you haven't told the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one crucial thing as you go through this process is self-awareness,
mm-hmm.
is identifying what you want out of life, what you don't want out of life, and then trying to align those aspirations with your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And as you do that consistently, again and again, you'll start to, your actions will bring forth what you want.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can share a quick example. It might be a little bit like, we're like finishing the conversation here.
Go for it.
But when I ran the Wasatch 100,
mm-hmm.
one of the things you had to do before the event was you had to go and work on the trails up in the mountains. And so you go up there with like pitchforks,
oh, okay.
and shovels and
like,
rakes.
Work on the trail. Okay.
And you're moving dirt to like create this good trail
okay.
to run on. And so you're basically engaging in community service.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one of the requirements you have to do. I think it was like 4 hours of community service or something, or 8 hours of community service.
Oh.
So we go up to this place up in the mountains and we're a group of us and we're like forming these trails, and it required a lot of work to get the trail nice and even and where we wanted it to go and everything. And the way that I kind of relate that to porn consumption is that you are, as you engage over and over, you're reinforcing that trail.
Mm-hmm.
You're reinforcing that neural pathway. Mm-hmm. And the longer, the more work you put into it, the more permanent that trail becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would encourage the listeners to engage in some
mm-hmm.
proactive, intentional work on rerouting your trail. Like if you don't like that trail anymore, if you don't like that neural pathway that says always turn to pornography, then take your shovel, take your pick, your wheelbarrow and all those things, and then get to work
mm-hmm.
and reroute that trail mm-hmm. to where you want it to be.
Yeah.
And it will take a lot of work. It will take a lot of time. I just want to acknowledge those people who are on the other side who are experiencing the betrayal trauma. I just want to acknowledge that
mm-hmm.
and encourage that person to get their, like, go to their resources mm-hmm. that are available to them. There's a lot of resources out there to help with that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take this on alone. Just like the compulsive behavior grows in secrecy,
mm-hmm.
it's very probable that if you hold in all of this information, this betrayal trauma, and you mm-hmm. hold on to it, it's very probable that that's going to grow and be more harmful than it would be if you were able to disclose that with a healthy group.
I love that. Well, Garrett, I just want to thank you again on behalf of all of our fighters for sharing your story in the capacity or in the ways that you've chosen to share it. And also to your lovely wife, Ariel. Like, obviously, this is a struggle you both had to go through together, and you both have had to decide to be very public in. And I know that both of your stories have really helped so many people who have been able to watch it and see it. So I just want to encourage anyone who's listening who's struggling to keep fighting, and for anyone whose partner is struggling and who's hurting from that to keep fighting for them, and to share this episode with someone who you think would be inspired by it. And again, to just go watch Garrett's video and go check out those resources that we have at ftnd.org/resources. But Garrett, thank you so much for being our podcast host and presenter and all-around phenomenal human being.
Well, thanks, Jazz. Thank you for hosting today,
or yeah,
for
helping thanks out for letting the podcast. Me. I hope it was okay.
It was great. We appreciate awesome. You.
Looking for a way to spread awareness on the harms of porn? Why not rep the movement in one of our conversation starting tees? With over 20 tees in various designs and phrases, you're bound to find something that speaks to you and will spark conversations with others. And the proceeds help to mobilize this movement. Get your gear today at ftnd.org/shop. That's ftnd.org/shop.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Consider Before Consuming. Consider Before Consuming is brought to you by Fight the New Drug. Fight the New Drug is a non-religious and non-legislative organization that exists to provide individuals the opportunity to make an informed decision regarding pornography by raising awareness on its harmful effects using only science, facts, and personal accounts. If you want to learn more about today's guest and the conversation we had, you can check out the links included with this episode. Again, big thanks to you for listening to this conversation. As you go about your day, we invite you to increase your self-awareness, look both ways, check your blind spots, and consider before consuming.